Hello and welcome to Dinner at Our Place. I am one of your co-hosts, Steve Pierce, here from our kitchen table, not from the closet this time. We got, you know, got my real microphones out. We're going to do it like civilized human beings who don't hide amongst their clothes. Joined, as always, around the table here, or across the table, really, by my wonderful and beautiful wife, Jessie. Jessie, how are you?
I'm good. It's good to be at our table and not stuffed away in the closet tonight. As much as I love you, I like having a little bit more space.
I'm glad that you're happy. If you're happy, then I'm happy.
I'm really excited, though, for tonight's episode. And thank you to everyone who listened last week to our first episode. But I'm really excited for tonight's episode and the questions that were sent in that we're going to answer. Tonight's episode is all about politics and religion, which is, I think, what everybody wants to hear about for the most part.
I heard that those two topics never cause any problems when people discuss them.
Everyone always agrees. Everyone always agrees.
Yeah, particularly together. They're just, they go together like peanut butter and jelly. It's great. It's all going to be good.
I'm actually really excited to hear your take, because as I said last week to everyone who's listening, we don't really prep for these. So I don't know how Steve's going to answer a lot of these questions. And I'm very excited to get his take on a lot of them, because I also have opinions about a lot of these things, but I'm more interested in Steve's. So let's just dive right in. The first question that was asked is, I think, one that a lot of people have, and it's, why do you think it's almost taboo to be liberal and Christian?
Really, again, starting with the simple stuff.
Here. I know. They're all big. We have six questions tonight, and they're all hard, big questions. So they're good. Get ready.
So this is a good question. And I think the most important thing to kind of start by saying is, A, conservatives do not have a monopoly on religion generally, and particularly not on Christianity. I think when we think of religious people, a lot of times in our political context in America, we think about white religious people, and they do tend to vote, at least historically, conservative and for Republican candidates. Mm-hmm. But there are more religious people and more Christians in this country than just white Christians. And for example, Black Christians, who have a strong history of Christianity in the historically Black church, historically Black congregations, they vote 90%+ for Democratic candidates. And they are just as religious, they are just as faithful as your, you know, what we would think of as your quote-unquote evangelical white Christians, but they vote completely differently. And so, you know, they believe in the same God. They worship, you know, the same Jesus, but their politics are different. And so I think, and
this is, so you're saying it's not taboo to be liberal and Christian?
It is not. It is in a certain kind of, in certain strains of Christianity.
Certain regions of the country even?
Sure. And certainly, you know, in our faith, we're Mormons, Latter-day Saints, however you want to say it. It certainly is, you know, there was a leader of our church many years ago, decades ago, who, you know, was a very virulent conservative. And he used to say that a member of the LDS church, you couldn't be a good Mormon and a Democrat. And so that is a thing that's incredibly personal to me, because obviously I try to be a good Mormon. I don't know if I succeed all
the
time.
You're a good Mormon.
And I'm obviously professionally a Democrat. I get paid to be a Democrat. And so trying to dispel this myth, and if you are a member of the Mormon church, you know that every election year, like a week before the election, the first presidency of the church, which is like the president of the church and his two counselors, they're kind of the highest authorities in the church, they send a letter to every congregation in the United States that is read over the pulpit every election year, in which they encourage everybody to vote. And importantly, it always ends by saying that the church is neutral in matters of politics, and that there are principles compatible with the gospel of Jesus Christ that can be found in all major parties. And you know, it's there every year, and it's very explicitly a message that you can believe whatever you want politically. Now, are we 50 years later, 70 years later, however long it's been, still fighting those incorrect folk doctrines that are embedded so deeply in our culture about how you can't be a member of the Mormon Church and a Democrat? Absolutely. 100%. That's still very, very real in people. It's culturally baked into us. But if you were to take the word straight from the leadership of the church, it's not true. And I don't think it's true. It's certainly not true in our faith. I don't think it's true of any faith. I think there are plenty of people of faith, of all types of faith, who believe in both major parties. And so I think it's actually quite destructive, both for our faiths, our different religions, for Christianity, modern Christianity in general, and for our country, when we try and tie the two together and try to, you know, force them into, if you believe in this thing religiously, you have to believe in this thing politically. I don't think that's good for religion. I don't think that's good for the country. And so I've spent, you know, obviously dedicated a good portion of my life and my energy into trying to dispel that notion. And so there's a whole history of how we got here. I just laid out a little bit of it in terms of just the LDS corner of the world. I think the most important thing is for those of us today is, you know, what we can control, which is to try and dispel that notion in ourselves, unlearn the things that have been baked into us culturally, and also try to dispel that notion for those who are in our immediate circle of influence and where we do what we say does matter and people might listen to us. And if enough people did that, maybe over a course of time, we could start changing some of these ideas.
That's really interesting. I'm actually going to switch around our questions a little bit because I think one of the other questions asked is a really good follow-up to this. And I actually had this exact same question. Someone asked, how have evangelicals become such a power group that seem to dominate policies and platforms? So I think this goes along with that idea of like Christian faiths in general. I think oftentimes people feel like the biggest one might be the evangelicals and how they have just like dominated the right wing. And so what do you think about that? Like how have they become such a powerhouse, like a power group that has just dominated policies and platforms?
Yeah. So there's whole books that have been written about the rise of the evangelical right. It goes back to the Moral Majority in the 70s. And it was, you know, and it goes back even further than that, back to conservatives trying to find a way to oppose Roosevelt's New Deal back in the 30s, which was incredibly popular. And Roosevelt obviously got reelected three times. He served, you know, three in a part of a term, and he ultimately died in office. Is the only way they got him out of office. He was incredibly popular. His policies were incredibly popular, and those who were opposed to the New Deal were looking for kind of any foothold that they could to try and oppose kind of Roosevelt's massive expansion of the role of government. And and one strategy that they used was they turned to preachers and pastors in these churches because they knew that those were respected members of community. And they contributed to their churches, they paid them money, they elevated their profile to speak out from a religious perspective against what was happening in the country, framing America as, you know, this as a quest for personal success, and that, you know, the encroaching communalism that Roosevelt's New Deal represented was an affront to that, was an affront to Christian values. And that's where it really starts.
Wait, hold up. But that's like so not true.
It's not true. But if you were, especially at the time, America was a much more religious country then.
Interesting.
Than it is now. And pastors and preachers, they were, you know, and still are for many folks, people of people to be respected.
Oh, totally.
People to be listened
you
to.
You know them.
And so if you,
you
went and sat in your pew every Sunday and your preacher, who you have personally entrusted to guide you, help guide you on your path back to God, or to, in the Christian sense, and he is telling you every week why what the president is doing is, and using scripture to to say, here's why what the president is doing is bad, over time, you either accept that or you go find another church, right?
And decades later, that just, the snowball builds and builds.
Right, and so that was the very, very beginning of it.
I had no idea. That's really interesting.
And there's a very great, a very interesting book that has just been written about that kind of time and those very beginnings. When the evangelicals really take off is in the 70s with the founding of the Moral Majority, and they really take hold in the 80s with Reagan. Reagan really sees the power of the church, the Christian, kind of the Christian church, as an organizing tool, as a built-in structure for organizing people, and really starts to play. Nixon did it before him, but Reagan really kind of revolutionizes how we play, how Republicans play to those quote unquote family values issues with an intention to mobilize Christians, knowing that there's this built-in community, this built-in kind of infrastructure for them taking action. They're used to taking action, banding together and taking action for the different causes that they're working on in the communities. Yeah. Why not use that and point that in a political direction to help us win? That's kind of the part of the strategy first of Nixon, and then Reagan really perfects it. And then in kind of the early 2000s, George W. Bush takes it and cranks it up to 11.
And Barbara Bush. And
I don't know if Barbara Bush had anything to do with it.
Does she have a lot of quotes about like the importance of...
You mean George W. Bush's mom or his wife?
No, his wife.
That's Laura Bush.
Laura Bush. About it. She has like a million quotes about like family and how like in the home, government and like...
I don't think so. I mean, not that I'm aware of. Maybe she does.
I feel like she has some quotes.
Laura Bush is a pretty moderate person.
That I've seen online that it's like, that could be mistaken for like a quote of like a general authority.
I don't know. I'm not as...
Listen to Steve.
I'm not as up on the...
On the first lady's quotes.
On the first lady's quotes. But Bush really is the first one who brings same-sex marriage to that equation and really starts to use that as a wedge issue, particularly in 2004 around his reelection. There's a lot of people who believe that Bush probably doesn't get reelected if Karl Rove doesn't successfully use same-sex marriage as a wedge issue to really gin up evangelical voters. They basically, because earlier in 2004, Massachusetts had legalized same-sex marriage as the first state in the country to do so. And so they used that as a wedge issue to say, look, if you don't reelect President Bush, the godless Democrats are going to come and they're going to make, you know, they're going to teach your children in schools about gay people. And they basically use it to scare.
A scare tactic.
Scare evangelical Christians and motivate them to turn out. And it was very effective. And he won by a very, very slim margin.
Interesting.
But it worked. And so, you know, it's a long history of evangelicals, kind of the rise of their power within the Republican Party. I think if you're going to trace back to why they've become such an influential force, it is that there's a lot of them. That's one thing. There's a lot of votes there.
Yeah.
B, they are very loyal to the party, and they tend to vote kind of not totally monolithically, but you know, white evangelicals for sure vote pretty monolithically, which means if you can win, if you're a party leader or a politician and you can win their support,
it's a lot of them.
That's huge, right? They can make or break your campaign if you can get the church folks on board, basically. And then they have the structure set up, especially now they've built political structures around those original religious, original church infrastructure. And so they can mobilize quickly and effectively. And so that's why they have so much power, and they just make up, they've become a very serious power center of the Republican Party. And, you know, I don't know, in the age of Trump, Trump is kind of the person in 2016, everyone said, the evangelicals in the primary, there was 20 Republicans running for that, for office, and Trump was not the first choice of the evangelicals. But he kind of rewrote the rules of the last 20 or 30 years of Republican politics, because he didn't start with a big kind of power base of support, or basically any base of support with religious voters. They came to him late when they kind of saw that he was going to win. And they moved over from the Ted Cruzes of the world and folks like that, the Ben Carsons of the world. And when it became clear that Trump, who is to their values, or at least what they would say their values are, is an odious human being, right? Who with terrible personal conduct, terrible scandals, terrible sexual history, cheating on his wife with porn stars, the whole thing, that people did, Democrats did much less than that in the past, and had evangelicals speak out and say, people with these types of moral character issues should not be running our country. We should not hold these people up as leaders to be, you know, examples to our children. But once they saw that Donald Trump was going to win, it was not, it did not take very long for many of those folks to swallow their principles and decide that this guy was going to get them closer to the policy goals that they want, which is ultimately conservative justices on the Supreme Court who are going to challenge gay rights and challenge abortion rights. That's the thing that they care about more
than
anything.
Those are the two issues they care about the
most. Those are the things they care about more than anything. And they decided this guy, if this is going to be the guy for the Republicans, he's going to get us closest to the goals that we want. And we're going to magically swallow all the criticisms we've had, we would have of somebody like him who and conducts himself in the way he is and is the type of person that he is, just to
Further their agenda.
To further our agenda. And to me, and obviously I'm speaking of this from a very biased point of view.
People are here for your biased point of view, Steve.
I think that was really sad. And I think it said, I think it spoke volumes about kind of the state of the evangelical right as a movement today. I think it just kind of hollowed out the soul. Or they had hollowed it already, and that was the evidence of that movement, whatever it started as. And I'm sure, I'm not here to say that they don't have, you know, real faith in Jesus or anything like that. But I think, you know, sometimes when it crosses into the political realm, I think sometimes they check some of the principles of what I would consider to be Christianity at the door when it's convenient. And I think that's gotten worse rather than it's gotten better. And I think it's a concern. I think it's something that you're seeing now a lot of evangelicals really grappling with.
I was going to say, where are they going in 2020? Because you see this data all the time.
Right. A lot of evangelicals, they're still going to vote for Trump. White evangelicals are still going to vote for Trump. But he's not winning them by the same margins that he did in 2016. There are a lot of folks who I think this was a wake-up call for them. And they said, you know, they, especially after seeing him as president for 4 years, they've said, you know, I can't support this. I can't do this anymore. And so we've actually seen, you know, support for Trump amongst white evangelicals swing back just a little bit and kind of pull back, because, and not to the extent that he's going to lose them.
Yeah.
That's not going to happen. That's not realistic. But enough so that there are folks that are speaking out, and I'm actually doing some work with some great organizations who are out there.
Yeah, plug your work. I didn't even think about that right now.
Who are out there organizing evangelicals, white evangelicals, Latino evangelicals in particular, to speak out against Donald Trump, to speak out in favor of Joe Biden, who is a man of great faith, a very devout
very
Catholic.
Very religious.
Very devout Catholic. And so I think, you know, there, 2016, I think, was maybe the nadir of this, kind of the bottom of the trough. Mm-hmm. And I hope, and I'm saying this as an outsider who's not a member of that faith community, so maybe I don't have the right to speak on their stuff. But I, as a person who respects all Christian faiths and wants, you know, all Christians like myself to be the best that we can be, I'm hopeful that this is kind of the beginning of a swing back towards more principle and less convenience.
Or even to kind of like you were talking about at the beginning, to kind of like unbake those cultural traditions, to kind of like lift a little bit of that and give people an opportunity to vote for someone else. And then, you know what, maybe in 4 years, it's not, you know what I mean? They'll see it as like, well, I voted for a Democrat and look, I'm still alive. It's not that bad. I can do it again.
Yeah. And this is, it's, you know, the swing is really coming from young evangelicals. And, you know, we know from the political science literature that you form your partisan identification when you're young. And the really the only times that oftentimes it's kind of
like baked, what, 18 to 30?
Oftentimes it's really baked into you as a child, mm-hmm. Because you kind of are what you're surrounded with. I told my story last week. And the only times that really changes, where there's really a consistently an opportunity for that to change, is around these big kind of milestone events in your life. When you leave home, which was what it was for me, when you get married, when you have a kid, when you get your first job, those are kind of these milestone markers, mm-hmm. where people tend to, if they're ever going to shift, they shift. And all of those really come in kind of those first 10 years after you leave home, a lot of those. And so that's a really big time. But if you get folks in that window, you're kind of, unless there's some giant, massive, cataclysmic national event that changes people, they're pretty much locked in for life. They don't change voting behavior. People don't change voting behavior.
Most really people often. Don't. There are the independent voters.
Yes, but most people do not change.
Interesting.
And who you voted for president the first time is incredibly predictive of how you will vote in all of the elections afterwards. That's not to say that people don't change. They do, and you'll always find those cases. But on the whole, people tend to continue to vote for the party that they voted for when they were young, because that's when it was kind of imprinted on them and they baked in there.
So the idea of young evangelicals potentially swinging more left towards Biden during this election says something.
Right. If you're an 18, 19, 20-year-old evangelical and you're, you know, really forming your political identity, or you could say this for members of the LDS church too, for Mormons.
Yeah.
If you're 18, 19, 20, and you're beginning to form your political identity, and you're forming that in a context where Donald Trump is an affront to everything that you believe, and you are getting ready to pull the lever for Joe Biden, that's a formative experience in your life that's going to influence everything that comes after. And this is my story, right? My first president that I voted for was Barack Obama. I was 18, 19, 20, and forming my political identity. And there was a leader that inspired me, who was Barack Obama, at that period of my life. And that set the template.
Yeah.
For everything that came after. And I'm not unique in that way. All these people won't go out to work in politics. They're not insane.
Yeah.
They're normal people. But
you're not insane. You're just passionate.
Sure. but these are normal people who are going to go out and have normal lives. But when it comes time to vote, it will matter to them. They might ultimately, maybe they'll all go back home and become Republicans after Trump is gone. If he ever really goes.
I was going to say, is he ever going to leave?
I think it's an interesting inflection point. I'll be very interested to see how it turns out here in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, interesting. All right. So we kind of spoke about religion in general, and I don't even know how you know all of that stuff about like FDR and through the 70s. I mean, Reagan, obviously, but like...
I read.
I know you do. It's something I should do. I watch documentaries. Does that count? Okay. But now I want to kind of turn towards, because a lot of our listeners are members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, our Mormon friends. And so there were a lot of questions that were more specific about Mormonism and not so much about Christianity in general or religion in general. So this was a really good one. It says, has it ever been hard to maintain your religious beliefs with your political views or vice versa? And so, I feel like we could talk about this all night.
Of course. Any of these questions you really can. Yes, it is not in the way that, you know, I feel like I have to choose. one over the other, but just it goes back to the cultural stuff that we were talking about. This broad, overarching sense that a lot of people feel, a lot of my co-religionists, to use a term that I like to use, feel like that people who believe in the things that I believe in don't belong. And mm-hmm. so I think, and I've talked to a lot of my friends who happen to be Mormons and, you know, more progressive or Democrats. And we all kind of have this same feeling. It feels like, and this is getting really, you know, deep into my psyche here.
Let's do it.
It feels like every day, and that's maybe slightly exaggeration, but just continually is a fight to stay in the church, because you don't feel like you belong. Like you're not, like sometimes that you're not really wanted, that there's
like, there's no representation in the church that looks
yeah,
like
you don't see a lot. You don't see a lot of people who look like you, think like you, held up, in the church. And obviously issues of representation are much worse in the church for particularly people of color, mm-hmm. And others. So I'm, you know,
women in leadership positions.
My problems are not the worst problem.
Who think like you?
Yeah, my problems are not. I don't have the worst challenges here.
Yeah,
I can blend in if I want to. But in terms of, you know, just feeling like there's a place for you, mm-hmm. and that this is a place where you're wanted and you're going to be accepted for who you are and for the things that you think. It's a real challenge, and I've had this conversation, like I said, with a lot of friends, and you know they all feel that way. You feel like you constantly have to defend yourself, even though you shouldn't. Even though the brethren say you can be whatever political party you want. Mm-hmm. There are principles of the gospel in all political parties. For some reason, we progressives, Democrats, are always put in the position, and it's not surprising what the reasons are. It's the cultural stuff that we talked about. But we're always the ones put in the position of having to defend why we should be there and mm-hmm. why we should be allowed to believe the things that we believe. And our friends on the other side of the aisle, our Republican friends, are rarely asked to defend that. Yes. I am asked all the time to defend how I can support a gay couple's right to have their marriage recognized by the federal government, all mm-hmm. and be a member of the church. I'm asked that constantly. But my Republican friends are not asked, basically ever, and they're not challenged on, you know, why do they believe that the biggest mechanism we have in American life, the federal government, which is a representation of our collective will as the people of the United States of America. That's what a government is. It's us all putting in our money and mm-hmm. giving our support to an organization to do things on our behalf. Why do they think that organization, which we are the bosses of, should not follow the counsel of Jesus and help the least of these, my brethren? Yeah. Why do they feel like the welfare state, which takes care of the people in this country who are having the hardest time, the poor, and Jesus says you cannot be saved without your poor, why do they think that we, through the course of our government and our tax dollars, shouldn't be following that yeah. counsel from Jesus?
Yeah.
So it's just a one side. It feels, you know,
yeah.
and this is very experiential, but it just feels like it's always a fight and you always have to defend yourself, and
you have to prove yourself and they don't have to prove theirs.
You're never comfortable. You never walk in and say, and you know, I always say that, you know, my relationship to the church is fairly tribal. These are my people. Even though I have my struggles with certain doctrine here and there, and sometimes I don't like some of the things the church does politically, I always come back because A, I'm a believer, but also B, because these are my people and they've always been my people. And this is my tribe.
Even though they're not like you, they're your people.
Yes. I have this cultural connection that's been baked into me from my birth. Right.
Yeah.
This is everything that I've known. But even with that, I never feel fully comfortable. I never feel fully wanted. I never feel fully myself. I always feel like I'm a little bit on edge. And I can only imagine that people who have, you know, who are even much more in the minority than I am, mm-hmm. people like, you know, people of color, women, I can only imagine how much more that feeling kind
magnifies
of pervades. It gets
them.
Magnified mm-hmm. for them because it's, this is a very small burden to carry in my case, because I'm, you know, a
you
very
recognize
privileged
you're self aware
guy.
Enough to see this, how it is different for you than other people, but you feel that way.
I feel that way, and I can't imagine how much that weighs on people who have, you know, much larger burdens to carry than me.
That's really interesting. I don't think I've ever, I mean, we've kind of talked about that, but I've like never heard you to talk about it in that way. So that's like, that's very interesting to me. I have to say, when we were first dating, when you got back from your mission and we were dating, so not when we were first dating, we had known each other for a few years, but we had a lot of conversations about this because, I felt like, you know, you grow up in the Mormon church and you're a Republican. That's just kind of what it is. And we had a lot of hard conversations about doctrine and about social issues, and it was really interesting to kind of experience that transition. I don't know, you're taught a certain thing when you're raised, whether it be in your home or at church, and to kind of like see the other side of it and to be able to make your own choices and to open your eyes and to learn more. And so I think I always say, and it wasn't because I left Utah. A lot of people, I think, see more as they leave Utah and as they go away from home, because a lot of Mormons live in Utah. But I think it's just about talking to people like you, like at the time I was talking to you and you had different viewpoints, but talking to people who are different and who have different viewpoints. And I think it opens your eyes. And maybe, I mean, not every situation is like this where I happen to agree with you and we get married and I support your progressive dreams forever. But it's just, it's good to talk to people that don't have the same viewpoints within the church.
Agreed. I'm always a fan of diversity in all forms. And when we think of that word, we often think of racial diversity. I think that's the thing that jumps, you know, first to folks' minds. And I'm very much in favor of that. But diversity of thought, particularly in fairly homogenous communities, and the LDS church, at least in politics for sure, and in a lot of other ways, is very homogenous. It's in the United States, at least. It's very different outside the United States. But I think that everybody could do, and I think the entire country could do with more listening and more seeking out people who are different than you on a number of different factors, right? Not just in your political views, but in their racial and ethnic background, in their religion, in some way
yeah.
in
Life
which they
experiences.
Are different from you. Just have people who have seen the world through a different set of eyes, walked in it in a different pair of shoes, and really learning from those people. And even if you don't have to agree with everything they say, but
you should listen.
You listen, and you listen not to say that you're listening and you want to check the box, but to listen for understanding.
Yeah.
And to try and not necessarily adopt everything that they say, but to understand where they come from. And I have a lot of friends who are Republicans.
You mean all our friends?
Most of my friends are Republicans, not all, but a lot of them.
We happen to live in Washington, D.C.
And reason why we are able to be friends is because I think we are able to listen for understanding. And we don't agree on a lot. Sometimes we don't agree on anything. But we're able to listen to each other and have a conversation, and knowing that we're probably not going to end up in the same place at the end of it. But the act of having the conversation and listening to the other person and understanding where they're coming from is in itself valuable. The journey in itself is valuable. The destination is far less important.
I'm jumping around questions because I think this actually parlays well into another question here that we got the most. And I don't think this question is going to surprise anybody. I think it's the hardest thing personally for me that I've had to experience. And I think this question is just, it's the question everybody's asked over the last 4 years. And it's, how do I maintain relationships with people who are avid Trump supporters? It feels impossible when dealing with family whose views are different from my own. So I think with what we were just talking about is kind of an answer to this question, but I'm hoping we can expand more. And I think this is something that everybody over the last 4 years four or five years has struggled with. Like it's just like there's a total disconnect between even Republicans and Trump people, right? Like I have a lot of friends that are Republicans, and then there's like the Trump people that are, it's a different breed in a way. And that second part really hits home. It feels impossible when dealing with family whose views are different than my own. So I'd love to open that question to you first, and then I'll kind of end with my answer to it. And of course, what we were kind of just talking about, I feel like we were in that vein. And so that's why we went with this question.
We were kind of, you know, down that road. And I will say, you know, it's really hard. If it were easy, we would have figured it out and people wouldn't be asking questions for us to talk about it.
We wouldn't be 4 years later.
Yeah.
I got this question a lot.
Yeah. It's really hard. And, you know, I think, you know, I don't have a clean answer to this, to be honest, up front. I think on the one hand, there are people, and you will hear this a lot in Mormon circles in particular, who will say, you know, if you are the type of person that is going to not be friends with somebody or not talk to somebody because of politics, then you're a bad person and you're part of the problem. I saw that today online.
Oh, I haven't seen that online.
Oh, 100%.
I'm not online enough.
There's a lot of people who think that. And I mean, I have a real problem with that line of thinking too. As much as I want everybody to respect each other and listen to each other, people who choose not to scale back their relationships with certain people over politics, they're not just doing this because, you know, they're not making these very difficult decisions. If we're seeking to understand here, people don't make these decisions lightly. You don't make decisions to cut people out of your life, and that's in a dramatic term, but effectively
scale back relationships is a good way to say it, Steve.
Yeah, but you don't choose to do that, you know, willy-nilly. These are people that in a lot of cases that we care about and that we love. But also, you know, people are approaching this from a place of deep principle. These aren't just things that they decided to believe on Tuesday and because it sounded fun. These are things that the principles that inform your political identity are core bedrock values that go to the core of who you are. And when you, you don't feel like somebody respects.
Yeah, that's the word.
The core of who you are. And it doesn't feel safe to be you and to be that, to have that part of you exposed. I can't blame somebody for not wanting to put themselves in that situation.
Why are you taking my answer? I hate it. Keep going.
I don't blame people who choose to approach it that way.
Yeah.
On the other side, do I think, and I just gave the spiel on this too, do I think that we should seek for understanding? Do I think that we should listen to each other and try to expose ourselves to people who feel differently than us? Yes, I do. I do believe that too. And so trying to hold both of those ideas in your hands at the same time is hard.
Really hard. When have you ever done this before kind of thing? It's not something you practice often.
Yeah, it's hard. And I don't think those two things are mutually exclusive. I think a lot of this comes down to respect, like we said earlier, mm-hmm. at the end of the day. We can disagree, but can we disagree without being disagreeable? I think, is a great challenge that Americans have right now generally. I think it's a challenge we have with family, where the tensions are that much higher because, you know, we have a lifetime of work and love and effort built into these relationships. The stakes are really high. And so that just makes everything harder.
Yeah, it's easy with a random person you met a year ago. It's right. harder with somebody right. who you know.
These are the
know.
People you love most in the world. And it's yeah. really hard. And so, you know, I think I'm not the type of person who thinks the best answer is always in the middle, always to try and split the difference. I wouldn't be in politics professionally if I thought that was true. I wouldn't be doing what I do. But I do think in this case, you know, you do have to give people a chance. And I'm going to be honest. I don't have a ton of friends who are super Trump folks. I just don't. There's not a lot that live in my area generally.
We don't have a lot of friends.
I don't have a lot of friends, first of all.
I mean that in the most loving way.
I'm a very few number of friends type of guy. You do tend to attract people who share the same values. That's how people, you know, we talk about polarization in America all the time and how did America become so polarized? And there's a lot of reasons behind that. But one of the reasons, and I think we talked about this on the last podcast too, is it is natural for people to be attracted to people who are like them and who share their values when we're talking about these types of things. And so it's not surprising that a lot of my friends are Democrats and progressives and are Republicans who I share some basic set of values with.
Yeah.
And even if where our values do differ, we're able to respect that those parts of each other.
Yeah.
And I think this is the challenge that a lot of people have had with kind of the Trump dynamic that has entered into this, is that I can't point the finger at, you know, everybody who's a big Trump fan individually, but I will say coming from the top down, from the man himself, that man is not big on respect.
No, not a word I'd use to describe him.
He's not big on respect of anybody who doesn't like him or agree with him.
He kind of cuts people out who don't agree with him.
Yes.
States.
He does. And I don't think
politicians.
That's not a big thing for me. And I don't think most Americans would disagree with that. He doesn't really believe in respecting people on the other side. He sees them as adversaries to be dominated and to be disposed of.
Yeah.
And so for people who are passionate fans of that type of figure and, you know, as happens, are taking their cues of how to engage around politics from him, it makes it very hard to have those respectful conversations. It makes it very hard to have a conversation with that person and feel like they are respecting your values and where you are coming from. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, for me, how do we kind of navigate, you know, those two things that I was talking about and hold them in our hands at the same time? I think you have to give people a chance. I think you have to be willing to engage in good faith and with an intent to listen, to understand. But when you get burned, you have to decide how many times you're going to be disrespected and how long you can tolerate that before you choose to step back from at least that part of the relationship. Mm-hmm. There are people in my life that I just know I don't talk about politics with.
Well, I feel like, and I mean, most people listening probably know this because they know you well-ish, but one thing about Steve that you would probably not expect is, do you know what I'm about to say?
I have no idea.
Is that a lot of people will talk to Steve and like be like, oh, you work in politics. And it's like they want to start talking politics because, you know, for some reason, it's not like if you have a brother-in-law that works in finance, you don't go like jazzing about finance. But for some reason, when you work in politics, people want to talk to you about it. And they think like, oh, it's my hobby and it's your profession, so let's like get chatting. But like if you bring up politics with Steve, he just like ignores it and he just like changes the subject at all costs. And we'll talk about absolutely anything else multiple times. Like for Steve to talk politics with you, he has to feel really comfortable and really close and feel really safe. I don't know if safe's the word, but like you only talk politics with a very few people, but like not with a lot of people. And it's probably a good thing because you don't, and it's probably back to that whole idea of not feeling like a sense of belonging culturally in the Mormon church. And a lot of the people you interact with are Mormons. I don't know what it is, but like, you don't talk politics with a lot of people. Yeah, like my family never, I mean, my siblings try to bring it up and you don't, like, you don't talk politics with a lot of people. And so I think part of this is you're really good at just not doing that. Because yeah, I mean, you probably don't agree.
A part of it.
And you also don't want to like completely like massacre them because you're probably better at it than them.
Right. So like a part of it is, you know, I do this for a living all day, every day. And sometimes when I go home from work, I don't want to talk about work. That's how, even though I love my work, like sometimes you're just like, I want to talk about something else. And, but it's totally understandable. I don't want people to get the impression that they can never talk to me about politics if they see me, because that's not what I'm saying either.
I would say it's probably mostly just my family then. No,
that's not true. But you know, you want to avoid conversations that you know aren't going to go in a way that's going to be productive and going to bring you closer together.
Yeah, that's true.
And so, and this is not just about particular, like whose family and which friends. This is just generally in life. People, I know I am conflict averse. There are some people who are wired differently than me, but I think most people don't enjoy conflict.
Especially with people you love.
Especially with people that you care about. And so I think it is, you know, it is important to kind of constantly to engage. I think it is important that we engage, but to also be realistic with yourself about what mm-hmm. you're gonna, is having this conversation with this person, is it going to end? Is there any chance that it ends well? And I feel bad saying that because, you know, I am the person who would say that you should try and like have the conversation, and even if you disagree, you should try and, you know, maybe you can change their mind. As you know, speaking for myself as an evangelist of my personal political point of view, I would love to change everybody's mind and make everybody agree with me, but sometimes it's just not worth it.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just have to, and this is not to say that you cannot be friends with them or have a relationship with them. You just maybe can't have that piece of the relationship.
Yeah, and that's what you were saying before, and I think you're really good at that. I think you're really good at having relationships that engage in a lot of other areas and not necessarily in that area.
And let me say, you know, I am a person who my entire life is dedicated to politics, like most of my day, right? Like I spend
a lot of your day right now.
Like hours and hours and hours is what I do with most of my life, is I work, and I work in politics. This is the thing I care a lot about. And let me tell you, even for somebody like me who cares that much about this stuff, you can have relationships without it. There are lots of other things in life that you can connect with people about that do not have to require you to discuss the latest news from the presidential election.
Yeah. So I think to take everything you said, I mean, and if you have more, please add, but I think to take everything you said and like to kind of bullet point it from this, and then to add a few thoughts of mine are like, one, be respectful. Two, listen and don't have a conversation trying to change their mind, but like be willing to listen to them as a human, because you're trying to learn, you know, their point of view and see their side. Not that they're going to change your opinion, your mind, and you're not going to change theirs, but just listen. But when you have done that, and you know, maybe the conversations have gotten tense and you feel like relationships are strained, my advice, and this is very personal advice, is to just remove that part for now and focus on the other parts of the relationship. And I think, I mean, I don't think it's a secret that my parents are giant Trump fans, and you can go drive past their house in Salt Lake and see the Trump fan in their yard. And it's been hard. It's a really hard thing. And I don't need to worry. I can talk about it here all I want because they're not going to be listening to this podcast. But it's really hard to feel like I have parents that are just on another planet, and then not just have a husband that works in Democratic politics. And it's not like I'm in between. I'm torn in between because I very much agree with Steve, and I'm very much a progressive myself. And so it's a hard thing to balance. And it's you're holding both those balls, as you were talking about, Steve, both those things in your hand. And it's a really hard time to navigate these relationships. And what I've learned is to, you know, there are times that those relationships might be scaled back, or there are times when certain parts of those relationships might not, you just might not talk about. Like, so for example, during COVID, it was really hard during, you know, when everything was shut down, to even a conversation of like, hi, how are you? What have you been up to? Got political. Because it was like, well, what have you been up to? Well, what are you up to? Like, and it's like, you know, the masks, the not masks. Are you going out? Like, everything is political. And it was this way. It's been this way for, you know, a decade. And it's not going to probably get better anytime soon. And so it really can be, I guess this is sounding like a really pessimistic downer. It's going in a really downer direction. But like, just try to remove the disagree, the political parts of a relationship that you might disagree with, and just focus on the other stuff. And so for like me with my parents, we talk about the kids, and that's all we talk about, because everything else kind of doesn't necessarily go in a great way. But I got two kids, and as long as Cohen's not shouting out like, I voted for Joe Biden, we're okay. Or like, Grandma, did you vote for Bernie? It's like, it can get, it could even get awkward then, but we just like, you know, just try to maybe for now with those relationships with people who support Trump, maybe just don't talk about that. Like, and maybe you don't talk to them as often, or maybe, you know, it's hard. It's like you kind of said, it's like you're like, for me personally, my deepest values, like the thing that gets me the most, I'm just going to talk about this here, I guess, but the thing that gets me the most, like the most important thing to me, Steve, if there was one value that's the most important thing to me, what is it? What value is most important?
Fairness.
Oh, besides fairness.
I don't know. What
honesty?
Honesty, sure.
If you don't agree with me, I always tell Steve, I'm like, you can do anything, but you got to tell me the truth. Like for me, it's like honesty is like the thing. You lie to me, like you are out of my life. But like, so for me to feel like, you know, a cornerstone of my values is like honesty and telling the truth, and to have a president that is really good at not being honest. And I think most people would agree with that. Like, he is not an honest person. And then to see my parents supporting somebody who's not an honest person has like really, really caused me to think about the foundation, the home I was raised in, and like my foundation as a person of values. And so it's hard. This is a really hard time. It's not easy for anyone. I'm like jealous of those families where everybody in their family agrees and feels the same, you know what I mean? And politically is in the same place. Like, it's that I'm super jealous of that. But at the same time, I think we will get through this and it will get better. And so if we can just like focus on the parts of the relationships that are good and that are not going to, you know, be strained for now, maybe that's enough.
Yeah. And, you know, if it was easy, so many people wouldn't be having this challenge. You are not alone.
Oh, no, I think challenge. A lot of people are.
And so I think it's, you know, doing the things that, you know, Jesse bulleted out there. And also, but also knowing that you can only control what you can control. You can't control what the other person is going to do. So you mm-hmm. can try, and you don't just remove that part of the relationship like Jesse was talking about. We can all try to do that and just have a relationship be about other things, and that's not a part of our lives that we share with each other. But if the other person is not able or willing to have that kind of relationship and continues to try and push the politics into the relationship to the point where you feel like it's not, you know, your values are not being respected and honored, and you feel attacked, if that happens enough times and it's just become clear to you that this person is just not ready and willing to have the type of relationship that
a respectful
yeah. relationship that's about other things. We can't have a respectful relationship about with politics in it, and they're not ready or willing to have a relationship that doesn't have politics in it. Maybe you do need to step back a little bit altogether, but I would not make that your first course of action. Yeah. Like we talked about, there are other things that you can do first. And I agree with Jesse that, you know, I am hopeful, I'm an optimist, but I am hopeful that, you know, we are getting to the top of this hill, and that when we look down the other side, hopefully, you know, things look a little bit brighter. There's a lot of reasons to not feel optimistic too, but I choose to feel like we as human beings, even though we disagree, even though we have our many, many challenges, human beings are inherently good. And we inherently want not only the best for ourselves, but the best for those around us, particularly those that we love. And I just think that it's that piece of us that's at the very core of who we are as people on this planet, as members of the big human family. I think that wins out in the end.
I think it will too. So that was a really good conversation, answering really hard questions. You surprised me, Steve. You always do a great job, but I was really surprised by the thought in those answers with winging it.
It was, it was a lot. It was a lot, but we covered some good ground. These are important questions. I'm appreciative of the people who would, obviously we're not revealing names or anything as part of this, but who would trust us enough to ask the questions and who are, obviously back to my, listening with an intent to understand and to learn thing. You're asking these questions, and then I assume if you ask the questions, you're planning to listen to the podcast because you want to learn, because you want to gain some understanding. I'm honored, honestly, that you think that we could provide some level of understanding, but it's just divorced from all of that. It's just really good to have these conversations with you and talk about these things, because these are just not conversations that we get to have around the dinner table with our two kids trying to throw food at each other and everything else that goes on during normal life.
Cohen would never let such a thorough conversation happen without it being about him. So we had a few others we didn't get to tonight, but we will try to include them in the future weeks. Next week's episode is about the 2020 election.
Have we not been talking about that every week?
I mean, we kind of have, but it's specifically about the 2020 election, which I'm super excited about, because little do you know that, like, I think Steve, like 92% of Steve's brain is currently being occupied by the 2020 election. So I'm really excited to like get the full experience of talking about the election with you.
It's going to be great. It's I don't remember what the questions are.
Well, wing it, of course, but it'll be so great.
If people have other questions about the 2020 election that they haven't submitted yet, you can still do that.
Yes,
feel free to send them in.
Please message me on Instagram, because I don't think there's anyone more qualified that I personally know to talk about the 2020 election than you. And we'll try not to let you get too geeky and nitty gritty on like numbers and data, but we might just go
I'm
there.
Not even one of the geeks.
You should but you're kind of geeky.
I mean, I do this professionally, but there are people that I work with who are the real data geeks. They could really get in the numbers with you.
Does that make you feel good about yourself that you're not the geekiest?
I'm one of the dumbest people that I work with. So,
well, anyway, thank you for listening, and thank you to everyone who has sent in questions. It seriously means so much. We'll be back again next week, again, talking about 2020. If you have any other questions, let us know. And thanks for listening.
See you next week.